Lecture 32, Fukuzawa Yukichi and Han Yugen.
Hi, welcome back. When we began this section of the course, one that I called East Meets West, I introduced four ways in which Asian thinkers might respond to the military and the technological dominance of Europe. Asians might respond as traditionalists, as adopters, as proselytizers, and as westernizers. We started our survey of modern Asia in India, where we saw two adopters, Muhammad Iqbal and Rabindranath Tagore, and then one proselytizer, Mahatma Gandhi. In this lecture, we're going to shift our attention eastward to Japan and to Korea, where we'll fill out that model with a westernizer, Fukuzawa Yukichi, and a traditionalist, Han Yong-un. But first, let me give you some historical background so that we can set these two great minds into a political and cultural context. The last time we talked about Japan, our topic was the influence of Zen on medieval art and culture. And we ended that discussion by speaking of Sen no Rikyu. Remember, he was the tea master to Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Actually, in that lecture, I forgot to mention that Rikyu was ordered to commit suicide by Hideyoshi under mysterious circumstances, sort of a strange thing. Hideyoshi was the second of three remarkable military leaders at the end of the 16th century in Japan. This was what they called in Japan the Warring States period. There was an earlier Warring States period in China, much earlier, but now we're back in Japan. So 16th century, a time when local lords called daimyo were fighting to conquer their rivals and to unify Japan. Oda Nobunaga began the process of unification, but then he was assassinated. He was followed by Hideyoshi, who very nearly consolidated his control of Japan and even launched an invasion of Korea. But neither of those two men was able to claim the title of shogun. That was left to Tokugawa Ieyasu, who established the Tokugawa shogunate, named after himself, in 1603, and then he ruled from Edo, which is present-day Tokyo. After more than a century of turmoil, Tokugawa wanted to stabilize Japan, and he did so by basically freezing its social structure. There were still about 200 daimyo all over the country who maintained their feudal domains, but they were closely supervised by the Tokugawa shoguns. Taxes were set at fixed levels, and social classes were made hereditary. So there were samurai, and then peasants, and artisans, and merchants. Trade with the outside world came to a halt. Christianity was outlawed, and all foreigners were expelled. Almost all foreigners. The exception was about 25 Dutchmen. No wives were allowed. And those men were confined to a tiny artificial island in Nagasaki Harbor. The island was called Dejima, and it was little more than a football field in size. So whereas Nobunaga had welcomed foreign technology and imported firearms, Tokugawa Ieyasu encouraged the newly underutilized samurai to concentrate on archery and swordsmanship. Japan was almost completely sealed off from the rest of the world, and the West in particular. During this period, Neo-Confucianism, which was borrowed from China, became the dominant system of thought in Japan. So some of the key figures from the late 16th, early 17th centuries in Japanese Neo-Confucianism include Fujiwara Seika, who studied that ideology with a Korean scholar who was a prisoner of war in Japan. And then there was also a man named Hayashi Razan, who synthesized Neo-Confucianism from China with Shinto, which was the Japanese native religion, and he brought those together to make them an official ideology of the Tokugawa shogunate. Neo-Confucianism continued to develop during the Tokugawa period, as did the study of Japanese history and literature. So there were scholars who concentrated on books like Lady Murasaki's Tale of Genji, which was written in a very old form of Japanese that needed to be kind of deciphered and updated. And that scholarship was called national learning. But there were hints of dramatic transformations in Europe, hints that came mostly through limited contact with the Dutch, or the red-haired barbarians, as they were commonly known. This is those small group of traders on Dejima Island. In 1720, the shogun allowed the importation of Western books on all subjects except for Christianity, and some Japanese scholars began to try and work out the meaning of all of this on their own, and their studies were, naturally, referred to as Dutch learning. So national learning and Dutch learning. Try to imagine what it was like at that time. You know that outside of your tightly regulated, closed-off society, there are immensely important things happening, but it's really hard to get any information. So in the late 18th century, the physician Sugita Gempaku and some of his friends came into possession of a Dutch book on human anatomy. Okay. They can't read Dutch, but the book is illustrated. It's got pictures. And on March 4th, 1771, they attend the dissection of an executed criminal. As the butcher, who's doing the actual cutting, pulls out one internal organ after another, they're amazed when these organs match up exactly with what they're seeing in the pictures of this Western text. And they're nothing like what their Chinese medical manuals had described. Okay, this is kind of shocking because everything from China has been admired and it's sort of been the teacher for them. And now there's this disjunction. Now, when this is happening, their first thought is, well, perhaps Chinese people and Japanese people have different internal organs. And it turns out that the insides of Japanese bodies are like the insides of a Dutch body. But of course, that doesn't really work out so much. And they soon realize, shockingly, that Western knowledge of the body was vastly superior. And they spend the next 3 years trying to make a translation of the text that went along with these illustrations. There was a fair amount of this going on, but they were still rather tentative attempts to indirectly bridge the gap between East and West. That came to an end in July of 1853 when Commodore Perry, Matthew Perry, sailed into the Tokyo Bay with 4 U.S. warships and basically said to the Japanese, open up your country to trade or else. We'll be back next year to talk about it. In the next year, 1854, a treaty was signed between the U.S. and Japan, followed shortly by treaties with Britain, France, Holland, and Russia. In every case, the Western powers were pushing for more trade and more access, and the treaties they imposed were inherently unequal, since they were forced on an unwilling partner. They also included extraterritoriality, which is the legal notion that the citizens of a foreign country are not subject to the rules of that country, the laws of, say, Japan, but instead they're subject to the laws of whatever native country they came from. This accommodation with the West caused a political crisis. There were plenty of Japanese samurai who wanted to fight against the West, to reject it entirely. The government, unfortunately, realized that that was going to be impossible. They knew a little bit more about Western military capabilities, and so they had to come to terms with the West. But there was a great deal of unhappiness with that. And finally, there was a coup in which some mid-level samurai seized control of the government, but in the name of the emperor as opposed to the shogun. And the Tokugawa shogunate collapsed. The Meiji Restoration is the name of this movement. It was named for the Meiji Emperor, who was 15 years old at the time. So this Meiji Restoration began in 1868, and this was probably the most successful, most rapid modernization in world history. With the whole-scale adoption of Western science and technology, Japan went from being a medieval society with bows and spears to defeating a Western power, Russia, in 1905 with modern warships and cannon. This was the first time an Asian country had ever defeated a modern European state, and Teddy Roosevelt, of all people, won the 1906 Nobel Peace Prize for mediating the peace treaty between Russia and Japan. Along the way, in this rapid modernization, Japan also beat China in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 to 1895, which came as a huge shock to China. I mean, China had been used to looking at Japan as sort of the little brother nation, sort of, and now Japan has defeated them. The story of Japanese modernization is fascinating, but for this lecture, I want to focus on a key figure in that process, and his name is Fukuzawa Yukichi. Fukuzawa was born in 1835 and lived until 1901. He was the most influential, most widely read intellectual in the Meiji period. Now, the Meiji period is named after that emperor, so he starts his reign when he's 15 in 1868, and then he dies in 1912. Fukuzawa Yukichi was born into a lower samurai family in southern Japan. He was an excellent student, but he chafed at the arrogance and the privilege of upper-class samurai boys. So lower samurai were forced to use humble language when addressing their superiors. They were taught a less refined form of riding. They had to walk while their betters rode on horses, and their educational opportunities were quite limited in comparison. Lower samurai were also wary of the rising power of merchants. They were sort of caught in between. Fukuzawa's own father was upset when he discovered that his sons were learning mathematics in addition to calligraphy and Confucian ethics. His father said, "It is abominable that innocent children should be taught to use numbers, the tool of merchants. There's no telling what the teacher may do next." Just sort of as an indication of how wary people were of mixing this new sort of mercantile culture. Fukuzawa was bright and ambitious, but his future was very limited in his native town. He saw a chance to escape at the age of 19 when he went to Nagasaki. Remember, that's where those few Dutchmen are. And then he went to Osaka later on for more Dutch studies. 4 years later, so this is 1858, the local officials sent him to Edo, the present-day Tokyo, to start a school of Dutch studies, Dutch learning, for young men from his native region. And that school later became Keio University, which is one of the preeminent private universities in Japan today. There was a problem, though. Soon after arriving at Edo, Fukuzawa went down to the foreign settlement at Yokohama, and by that time, there are a few more foreigners that are there. But he found, when he went to go visit this foreign enclave, that he couldn't read any of the signs. He couldn't read the labels on bottles, and no one understood a thing he said. As a language for access to Western culture, Dutch was almost useless, and his years of studying it were wasted. But in true fashion, he started learning English the very next day. In 1860, he went to America as part of the official mission to ratify the U.S.-Japanese trade treaty. So he was part of this first transoceanic voyage that was ever made by a Japanese ship. Fukuzawa was a keen observer, and he took careful notes on the postal system and the banking system. He went and saw hospitals and schools and newspapers, museums. He took notes on life insurance and family customs and relations between the sexes. He also tried to understand strange Western phenomena such as suspenders and collars and ties, as well as forks and beds and chamber pots. It was all new to him. He went to Europe in 1862 and then again to the U.S. in 1867. Starting in 1866, so this is the year before his second trip to America, Fukuzawa began publishing his observations in a series of three volumes entitled Conditions in the West. This was a runaway bestseller in Japan, with 150,000 copies of the first volume sold, and probably another 100,000 pirated copies. People in Japan were very hungry for this sort of information about the outside world. Another of his books, called An Encouragement of Learning, sold 420,000 copies in the 1870s, at a time when the population of Japan was only about 35 million. That means that one out of every 80 Japanese owned this book, and probably more sort of swapped it and read it. By the end of Fukuzawa's life, An Encouragement of Learning had gone through 17 printings for a total of 3.4 million copies. Today, Fukuzawa is thought of as a hero in Japanese culture. And since 1984, his picture has been on the 10,000 yen banknote. That's the largest bill in circulation. It's roughly comparable to our $100 bill. Fukuzawa urged his countrymen not only to adopt Western science and technology, but also Western values and institutions. As he wrote in his autobiography, "The Confucian civilization of the East seems to me to lack two things possessed by Western civilization." I'm going to pause for a minute. Two things they lack that the West has. What do you think those are? He says, "Science in the material sphere and a sense of independence in the spiritual sphere. I see now that this is the reason why Western statesmen govern their countries so successfully and Western businessmen are so successful in commerce and industry, and why the people are so patriotic and their family circles so happy. It all comes down," he says, "to science and independence." When Fukuzawa writes about independence, he means political independence, personal independence, and independent thinking as well. Now, it seems like Fukuzawa has opinions about everything. And as a wildly successful author and newspaper editor and educator, he was happy to share those opinions. But he carefully guarded his own independence. He never accepted a position in government, though he certainly took opportunities to offer his advice privately to officials. Fukuzawa attacked hierarchy. Remember his own unhappy experiences as a child from a lower level of the samurai class. He also was against authoritarian government and traditional education. In fact, he sometimes made fun of Confucian values. There was a traditional story of a filial son who doused himself in rice wine and then slept naked at the foot of his parents' bed in order to keep mosquitoes from biting them, right? He was just a much more attractive target to the insects. Fukuzawa suggested that it would be simpler and more effective to get some mosquito netting. In another passage, he wrote, "If we could look for the origins of Western civilization, it comes down to one thing." Okay, from two things to one thing now. And he says, doubt. Okay? What he admired in the West was the fact that they didn't just blindly accept tradition, and they weren't automatically obedient to authority. Fukuzawa was an apostle of freedom and equality, science, pragmatism, and progress. He also developed the art of public speaking in Japan. There was no earlier tradition of sort of public oratory, which he started based on models that he'd seen in the West. His huge bestseller, An Encouragement of Learning, began with the famous lines about equality. It says, "It is said that heaven does not create one man above or below another man. This means that when men are born from heaven, they are all equal." I'm still quoting. "There's no innate distinction between high and low." Okay, if people are equal, there's no innate distinction, why then are there differences? Obvious differences between rich people and poor people, between wise and stupid people. Fukuzawa says that success, those distinctions, come from hard work and education. And that education should include not only literacy and math, but also geography and physics, history, economics, and ethics, especially as contained in translations of Western books. The key to Japan's own success, he said, is getting rid of the samurai class, this hereditary class, and developing an independent-minded middle class. Okay, try to imagine how radical all this was. During the Tokugawa period, and even before, civilization, with a capital C, was Chinese civilization, shared only by Korea and Japan. Fukuzawa upends all of this in books like An Outline of the Theory of Civilization, published in 1875, where he argued that Western civilization should be Japan's model, not China. Where had China taken them, he asked. It was sort of a dead end. Fukuzawa once noted bitterly that no one would say that Japanese learning and business was equal to what was found in the West. "Who would compare our carts with their locomotives," he wrote, "or our swords with their pistols? We speak of the yin and yang and the five phases. They've discovered 60 elements." Fukuzawa goes on to say that the only thing Japan has to be proud of is its scenery. Ouch. All of this is in contrast to other Japanese thinkers who rejected everything Western out of hand with the slogan, "Sonno Joi," revere the emperor and expel the barbarians. There were other Japanese thinkers who advocated Eastern ethics and Western science. "Let's keep Confucian culture," they said, but we'll industrialize it by importing these machines from the West. Fukuzawa, however, realized, correctly, that Western culture comes as a package. It's not enough to import machinery and guns. The ability to maintain and develop such technologies depends on adopting Western values, such as independent thinking and equality. And that leads to reevaluating the basic foundations of one's life. We'll see this conundrum again in the next two lectures when we talk about China. For instance, thinking of reevaluating your life, what about the family? The family, as you'll remember, was the foundation of Confucian ethics. In his Outline of Civilization, Fukuzawa said that the traditional family structure is problematic since it's predicated on power and deference. He wanted more equality in marriage, along with education for women and the right to inherit property. He compared the traditional Japanese woman to an artificially stunted ornamental bonsai tree, which is kind of a disturbing image. Yet changing such basic customs, I mean, the whole idea of the family that people are raised with, it's That's very difficult. Fukuzawa's own daughters did not receive modern educations and had arranged marriages. Fukuzawa once admitted, speaking of his own failure to live up to his ideals, that a wine merchant is not always a drinker, a cake dealer does not always go in search of sweets. You should not make hasty judgment of the dealer's taste by what he sells in his shop. I mean, in other words, people don't always live by the principles that they espouse publicly. And even Fukuzawa gave no thought to women being involved in politics or in professional careers. Of course, women couldn't vote in the U.S. or in Britain either during Fukuzawa's lifetime. Although Fukuzawa began his career promoting individualism, freedom, and independence, by the end of his life, he'd shifted his energies to nationalism. In the struggle for progress, he felt that the community, in this case the nation, might take precedence over the individual. And in this, he adopted some of the bad habits of the West, at the West of the time, primarily colonialism. In 1885, frustrated at the lack of progress that was made by some of his Korean admirers, Fukuzawa wrote an article entitled On Leaving Asia, in which he suggested that Korea and China didn't have what it takes to modernize. As a result, Japan ought to, as he said, leave the ranks of Asian nations and cast our lot with the civilized nations of the West. In practical terms, this meant that Japan was ready to join in the Western exploitation of China and Korea. Several years earlier, in 1876, Japan had sent ships to Korea to force that closed kingdom to open its borders, much as Commodore Perry had done in Japan. The result was another unequal treaty, but this time it was Japan that was dictating the terms to Korea. In the 1880s, Japanese pressure on Korea increased, with tensions leading to war with China in 1894, because China claimed Korea as a tributary state, so it was involved in politics there. These are all grim events. The Japanese minister to Seoul had his men assassinate the Korean queen in 1895 and then burn her body on the spot. After China got involved, there was a war, and China was defeated, Japan grabbed Taiwan as a colony. The Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 1905 was also fought over control of Korea, and the result was Japan claimed Korea as a protectorate in 1905, and then finally annexed Korea outright in 1910. In so doing, Japan had joined the ranks of the colonizing Western powers, though, as you know, this is not going to turn out well. Japan's newfound enthusiasm for authoritarian government, aggressive foreign policy, and militarism will put it on the wrong side of history during the Second World War. And now, in this time of political turmoil, the second great mind of this lecture emerged, and that's the Korean patriot and poet Han Yong-un. Han is a traditionalist. He looks backwards for answers to contemporary issues, and in this case, the tradition that he draws upon is Buddhism. Han Yong-un lived from 1879 to 1944. He was also known by his literary name, Manhe, and he was born in southern Korea to a wealthy family that was part of a once powerful clan that had fallen into hard times. This meant that he was able to gain a traditional education in the Chinese classics because of this aristocratic background, but he nevertheless faced many of the same financial challenges and hardships as his commoner friends. Han was a strong, somewhat unruly child who was willing to use his fists to enforce what he thought was right. In accordance with customs of the time, he was married as a young teenager. But Han was increasingly drawn to spiritual matters. He came across a copy of the Flower Garland Sutra. That's the Huayin school. I remember we spoke about Fazang and this school earlier in when we talked about Chinese Buddhism. So he finds this sutra. He becomes interested. At the age of 18, he left his family to study in a Buddhist temple in Seoul. When he returned home 3 years later, the country was in an uproar with anti-Japanese rebels, anti-Western rebels, and neo-Confucian rebels all in armed insurrection. And his father, who was a low-level local military commander, had died in the fighting. Han's despair for Korea and for his own sense of meaninglessness in life led him to a deeper engagement with Buddhism, and he was ordained a monk at 26 in 1905, the same year that Japan defeated Russia and strengthened its hold on Korea. Han Yong-un was curious about the West, and he embarked on an adventure that led him to Vladivostok, Russia, which was a city very close to Korea. He sort of sailed there with no money or documents. He was with a couple monk companions. And there, he was nearly killed by Korean settlers who mistook him for a Japanese spy. At the time, Buddhism had nearly died out in Korea due to the strict Neo-Confucian orthodoxy. And many Buddhists found a natural ally in Japan, where Buddhism was much stronger. Han was definitely not a fan of the Japanese imperialism in Korea, but in an effort to learn still more about the outside world and more about Buddhism, he spent 6 months in Japan in 1908. There are three aspects to Han Jung-un's thought that make him remarkable: his patriotism, his Buddhism, and his poetry. Of course, there were other Korean patriots and Buddhists and poets, but Han was the only one, was the one person who combined all of these roles most successfully. In 1913, Han published a book entitled On the Revitalization of Buddhism in Korea. Like Muhammad Iqbal, he saw equality and freedom as key contemporary values, but he found precedence for them in Buddhism rather than in Islam. All people are born equal, he said, because, according to Mahayana Buddhism, everyone has the same identical Buddha nature within. Any sort of oppression is a denial of that innate equality. And also, in accordance with the Bodhisattva ideal, the opposite of egotism is salvation. Remember that Bodhisattvas make a vow that they won't go into nirvana until everyone else is enlightened as well. Okay, with these insights, Han Jung-un was able to affirm the Buddhist principle of compassion, which he believed was sorely lacking in the modern world. And in emphasizing compassionate action, he was also responding to criticisms of Buddhist renunciation, that Buddhists just, you know, leave society, they don't have anything to add. He was actually laying the groundwork for a more socially engaged form of the religion. He thought that Buddhism was actually less superstitious and less otherworldly than Christianity. I mean, remember that in Mahayana Buddhism, heavens and hells are created in one's own mind. This is in Yogacara Buddhism. So you're not actually trying to get to some other place, or it's sort of a more mental, even sort of rational religion, at least according to Han Jung-un. In addition, he felt that the identification of form and emptiness in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, remember that were talked about by Nagarjuna, he felt that that combination, form and emptiness, justified political activism, a sort of like being in the world but not of the world. Han went on to make specific suggestions about education for monks, about relocating temples from their mountainsides where they were inaccessible to urban areas where they would have more contact with regular people. He had advice about missionary outreach, and he talked about how meditation was more important than chanting the Nembutsu or the veneration of images. And he further argued that monks and nuns should be encouraged to have regular jobs and to marry. Since these ideas were not borrowed from the West, I've labeled him a traditionalist rather than an adopter, but even traditionalists can be reformers. Han Jung-un popularized his ideas through his writings, his translations, and commentaries on scripture, and also by editing journals and organizing lay Buddhist associations. Han believed that his ideas of equality and freedom had political implications, and he was one of the 33 signers of the Korean Declaration of Independence that was publicly announced on March 1st, 1919. This was during the Japanese occupation, of course, and the authors were inspired by Woodrow Wilson's call for self-determination and an end to colonialism the year before. Okay, they were also inspired by the American Declaration of Independence, too. The Japanese were caught off guard by the massive demonstrations of over a million Koreans that accompanied this announcement, and Japanese police and troops responded harshly. Korean sources reported nearly 47,000 arrests, 7,000 deaths, and 16,000 casualties over the next 3 months in the political infighting. Han himself was arrested and imprisoned for 3 years, during which time he wrote an essay entitled A Discourse on the Independence of Korea, in which he argued that Buddhist ideals of freedom must be accompanied by peace. Indeed, personal freedom required national independence and respect for the freedom of all human beings. Han Jung-un is remembered as well for his poetry, particularly a 1926 volume entitled The Silence of Everything Yearned For. That's Francis, Franziska chose marvelous translation. Sometimes the book is called The Silence of Love. Okay. Now, these poems are obviously love poems, but the object of his devotion, his affection, can be interpreted as a human lover, or the Korean nation, or even Buddhist enlightenment. What do you think? Let me give you an example. My love is gone. Ah, the one I love is gone. Crossing the narrow path to the maple grove that shatters the mountain green, she tore away from me. Promises like bright gold blossoms turned into ash scattered by gentle wind. The memory of a sharp first kiss reversed my destiny, and then retreating, faded away to nothing. Is he talking about a lover? Is he talking about the nation that has been taken by Japan, which might be the maple grove there? Or is he talking about some sort of feeling of an enlightenment experience that seemed within his grasp and then was gone? Who knows? In poetry, form matters. This poem was written in Korean rather than in Chinese, as was typical, and it was published in Hangul. Remember, that's the language reform, the alphabet, that was a significant part of Korean modernization. Okay, the script had been promoted by King Sejong the Great in 15th century, but even nearly 500 years later, it was still resisted by the educated elite in Korea. Han Yong-un's poems were also modeled after the free verse of Rabindranath Tagore, which had recently been translated into Korean. Fukuzawa Yukichi and Han Yong-un represented two different ways of responding to the West. Remember, one's a westernizer, one's a traditionalist. When we come back the next time, we'll see many of these same themes played out again in China. There are arguments about modernization versus cultural heritage in the context of internal weakness and Western imperialism and Japanese aggression. There will even be another massive popular uprising in 1919, but in China. We'll talk about that next time.